Om Parthaya Pratibhojitam Pagavatam Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Krantitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Parashinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanisuntadami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvaishinim. Okay, in chapter 6,
Udare Atmanat Manam Natmanam Avasadayet
Natmanam Avasadayet
Atmaiva Hyatmano Bandhu
Atmaiva Hyatmano Bandhu
Atmaiva Ripuratmanaha
Atmaiva Ripuratmanaha
Udaret Atmana Atmanam Na Atmanam Avasadayet Atmaivahi Atmano Bandhu Atmaivahi Atmanaha Bandhu Atma Eva Ripuhu Atmanaha. This is a famous verse. On all of these verses up till now, we're really talking about the yoga arudha, how a person becomes someone who is a sannyasi, sarva, you know, sarva karma sannyasi, sarva sankalpa sannyasi, one for who all of the sankalpas are not there. There's no more I need this to be happy. Right, that type of a vritti is not there. That's a yoga arudha, somebody who is mounted on, arudha means mounted, who's mounted on yoga means who has fulfilled that. And once a person becomes that through karma yoga, then that person becomes a sannyasi, and that person then recognizes oneself, the atma, as being sarva karma sannyasi, means somebody, the atma itself is akarta abhokta, is not a doer, is not an enjoyer, is ever the same, is kutasta. Okay, so how to get there? You know, what is the sadhana? And so this section before really going into the nature of meditation, which chapter 6 deals with, is the nature of meditation. It's really dealing with antakaran shuddhi and how that comes about. Because without the antakarana shuddhi and the karma yoga, which brings about that purity of mind, meditation is difficult. Right? The mind doesn't enjoy kind of a relative meditative stance for meditation to be something to practice. So without the karma yoga, that shamatvam, that shanti isn't a natural abiding shanti. You want the mind to have some sort of naturally abiding shanti in order to be able to meditate. Right? In fact, when we're teaching meditation, we do all different types of exercises just while we're seated in meditation to bring about to bring about the mind into a certain resolve before we even start meditating. And so here, this is taking it out into the world to be how to be in the world in such a way to bring about that shanti. And then when one sits, you do exercises to increase that shanti, and then increasing that shanti, then you begin meditating. Okay, so he's covering, Krishna is covering all of the bases here. It's really, really good. So here he says this famous verse, udare atmana atmanam. One should bring up, pull up, rescue. If a person is drowning, they're being grabbed. Hara means to grab and to pull up, you know, to pull them out of the water. They're drowning in the water, and Ut stands for pulling up, and dahara means to grab and to take away, to remove away. So they remove away up, save them from drowning. So one should save oneself by oneself. So atmana, by the self, atmanam, the self, buddhare. One needs to rescue, to save oneself by the self. So who's the self? The atmanam here is the mind. Right? Because we refer, just like in English, we refer to the self in terms of the body, in terms of the mind, in terms of the prana, in terms of the sense organs. We can say, I'm seeing this, I'm hearing that. It's all referring to we're identifying the Atma with the Upadhi. So Atma is a word that is not just used for Brahman, right? We have to be clear on that. Or it's not just used for the Pratyagatma. Atma is used for whatever we're referring as myself. And so here if I say I need to rescue, one must rescue the self by the self, what are they talking about? So the Atmanam is what we call the first Atmanam. I need to rescue the self by the self. The first self, Atmanam, is the Karya Karana Sanghata. It's a technical term. But it means the body-mind complex. Where the Karya means the body. The Karana stands for the sense organs and the mind. Karana means instruments. So the mind and the sense organs are the instruments. Organs of action also. Those are the instruments. The karya is the product, is the actual thing that's been produced. And so the karya refers to the body. Okay? So when you say karya karana sanghata, sanghata means the collection, the aggregate. So Swamiji will use this term in teaching all the time to say karya karana sanghata. Means the body, mind, sense complex. So one should rescue this person here, this jiva, this body, mind, sense complex, atmana, by the self. By the self is not the Atma. The Atma is not doing anything. The Atma is not rescuing anything. So what is going to rescue the body, mind, sense complex is the buddhi, really. Right? Because the buddhi is the one that really, really controls the body, the mind, and the sense organs. So the buddhi is the one that has to rein all of this in. So we could say the body's not going to rescue the body. The body is basically inert. It's enlivened by the sukshma sharira. The sense organs are under the control, hopefully, of the buddhi. If they're not under the control of the buddhi, and are under the control of the manas, means just the mind under the control of desire, then in fact, as we'll see in the next line, the mind becomes your enemy. Right? The mind can also be the enemy. So what this first line says is, one should rescue the Atma by the self by the self. One should rescue the body, mind, sense complex, this person here, by the self, by their mind. Right? Na Atmanam avasadiyet. They should not destroy the self. One should rescue the self. Your buddhi, your mind, needs to rescue yourself, not destroy yourself. There's a lot in this. There's a lot of Swamiji's teaching in terms of antakarana shuddhi and how to be with yourself is in this. One needs to rescue oneself. One shouldn't destroy oneself. And he says, Atma evahi atmanah bandhu. It is the Atma alone, the self alone, that is the bandhu. Bandhu means relative, but really here in this sense it means the friend or the benefactor, the one who stands by, the one who really helps. The Atma eva atmanaha bandhu. The Atma alone is the friend of the self. Okay? Then it says, the Atma eva ripuhu atmanaha. And the Atma alone is the enemy of the self. Okay? So you can say the mind, the buddhi, is the friend of the self, is the mind, the buddhi, that is the enemy of the self. Now it doesn't just say the mind or the buddhi is the friend of the self, of the karya karana sanghata. It says atma eva. Only the mind, right? Only the mind, nothing else. Right? There is no enemy out here. There's no real friend out here. It all depends upon how you are, right, with the world. Whether this is inimical to you or whether this is friendly to you. What does it mean? What is it? What does friendship mean? And what does enemy mean here? So here, just to go over the verse, and these next couple of verses are going to deal with this more. One should pull up the self. One should pull up the self by the self. One should not destroy the self. The Atma alone is the bandhu, is the benefactor of the self. The Atma alone is the ripu, is the enemy of the self. So here, in reality, yourself is the Atma. In reality, the self that you are is Ananda. It is whole, it is complete. In fact, it's the very being of the whole creation. In fact, it is Ishvara. In reality, the Atma needs nothing. And even in reality, when I say in reality, even experientially, for a jnani and a jnani, the Atma needs nothing. The Atma is absolutely full, absolutely whole, absolutely complete. For the jnani, that's recognized. For the ajnani, it's not recognized. Because for the ajnani, there's no differentiation between the state of mind and the one who is illumining the state of mind. Right? That's it. There's a huge difference there. Just if you take any vritti that you have, any thought modification that you have, you are present. Let me use language like this. You are present as the very self of that thought, of the conscious being, right, which illumines the thought, which is the self of the thought, which can be differentiated from the thought in terms of subject-object. It is your thought. Even in, as ajnanis, we talk like this. This is my thought. This is what I was thinking. This is what I was feeling. This was my emotion. Right? So there's always an I present as the very one for whom the thought is, the very one for whom the experience is. We take that totally for granted. And yet, there's never a differentiation between the one for whom the thought is, the one for whom the experience is. We don't differentiate that I from the experience itself. Right? And so therefore, I am the experience. We don't recognize the constant presence of myself, the one for whom all the experiences are. This is a no-brainer in a way. Because now if I say that, you'll all go, yes, of course. All of the experiences, I am present. I am the one present to all of the experiences that I have. All of the emotions that I have, all of the feelings that I have, all of the perceptions that I have, all of the experiences that I have, without exception, I am present to all of them. But every single one of those experiences is negated by the next experience. Every emotion is negated by the next emotion. Every perception is negated by the next perception. So in this, what we talked about at the last class, this anvaya vyatireka, differentiation has to be understood in reference to my experience, because in every single moment, every single experience, I can do the anvaya vyatireka where I say, I am, the experience is I am. Right? That's the anvaya. This experience is I am. This experience is I am. This next experience is I am. That's all anvaya. The vyatireka would be, when this experience goes, I go. That doesn't work. There's no vyatireka. Right? So what the reality is I am, this experience is. Or this experience is I am. This experience is not, I still am. Right? There's no exception to it. On every single level of your self, of your experience, this holds true. I can do that anvaya vyatireka in reference to the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state, which is how it's, when we think of anvaya vyatireka, we think of it in terms of the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state. When the waking state is there, I am. When the dream state is there, the waking state isn't, but I am. When the deep sleep state is there, the waking state is not there, the dream state is not there, but I am. That's the anvayavyatireka. But that anvayavyatireka has to be applied to every moment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, in fact, what the anvayavyatireka logically and experientially, logically proves the fact of the experience that if I am, the other is, but if the other goes away and I still am, then I'm not that. Because it's gone and I still am. And so anything in my experience that can go, any experience that I can be without, is not essential to my being. Because here I am without it. And so what in terms of my mind, in terms of the buddhi, in terms of my emotions, in terms of my experience, is unfailingly present. And that which is unfailingly present, we take absolutely for granted because it is the constant in every single experience. And because it is the constant, I am the constant in every single experience. I don't notice that. I only notice the changing experiences. And so now what I have to do is shift my orientation to recognize the one who is constant in every experience, which is me, the conscious being that is absolutely most dear, the one who is the self of all of the experiences, not separate from the experiences, not removed from the experiences, but at the same time free of the experiences, right? Because I can't say that my mind doesn't enjoy me. If it didn't enjoy me, I couldn't make the mistake saying I am the mind. When I say I am the mind, there's no experience of myself being here and the mind being here. I say I am the mind because, in fact, I am the very self of the mind. But the mind, when we think of the mind, it's all of the moods, the emotions, the thoughts, the perceptions, all of which are coming and going in me that is remaining gutasta. Gutasta means like an anvil, not changing, not moving, not modifying in any way. And so the viveka, this is why the viveka has to be done, because the mitya and the satyam are in one and the same place. It's not that mitya is away from satyam. Mitya can't be away from satyam, or it can't be. Mitya, the truth of mitya is satyam. The truth of the pot is the clay. The truth of the snake is the rope. One can't be without the other. And so this, the mitya mind is mitya because it comes and goes, right? It has no being of its own. Its satyam is me. But now that differentiation has to be made. I have to see there's a kutasta. There's someone here that doesn't come and go. That is me. And that me is what I seek. That is the wholeness that I seek. That wholeness, the wholeness that I am, I seek. That means that there is a wall, in a sense, of ajnanam between myself and myself, right? Between the mind and the self. And so now, because of that wall of ajnanam, wall is not a good, because I don't want you to think that there's anything blocking you from yourself, right? Because of that non-recognition, because of the non-recognition, which is because of the adhyasa, the ignorance, you know, which causes the superimposition, right? My mind takes itself to be me. Taking itself to be me, then I become a changing entity. I am sorrowful or I am happy. I am agitated, I am sad. I am whatever the emotion happens to be. Now, I need to rectify this situation. And that's where jnanam comes in. So here, because there's a situation that has to be rectified, what does it mean really? Is that there is, because of the jnanam, there is a jiva. There's an ahankara. There's somebody who says, a mind that says, you know, I am this individual who needs to be happy, who needs to be full, who needs to be complete. This is the I could say hridaya granthihi. This is the knot of the heart, right? This is the problem right here. It's this ahankara. And so now, this ahankara has a buddhi. I can say it like that. The buddhi means, I say as a jiva, I say, you know, I am a conscious being. I am a conscious being. I can think. Right? I can make decisions. I have moods. I have emotions. I have things that I want. I have things to accomplish, things that I want to do. And so this buddhi goes about trying to accomplish all of these things, which is basically what? Is to make me happy. That's what I'm trying to do, is to make me secure, to make me whole, to make me happy. This is what I'm trying to accomplish. And so now, the tact I take as a buddhi, as a jiva with a mind, as a buddhi, the tact that I take to accomplish this, you know, is going to create a positive environment for me, or it's going to create a destructive environment for me, the tack that I take. Okay? It's obvious. I mean, say if I say, just to be, make it very simple, say if I, as just as an agnani, as a samsari, I say, I need this to be happy. Which every samsari says, I need this to be happy. If the means I take to accomplish that are adharmic, I become a ripu. I become an enemy to myself. Because I'm creating not only pain for others, but I'm creating pain for myself. If the means I take to accomplish, I need this to be happy, are dharmic, I am becoming a friend to myself. Because by the following of dharma, this is just on this level, by the following of dharma, I gain shanti. Right? Shanti means peace. Shanti means that my mind, which is illumined by myself, is in a condition which is not at odds or non-resonant with myself. And so I feel at peace. That's why I feel at peace. There's no discord between my being and the nature of my mind. Right? And so my mind thinks, oh, all is well with me. When the mind is upset or agitated, because there's a total identification with the between the self and the mind, and the mind is in a condition which is inimical or non-resonant with myself, the mind feels, things are not well with me. Things are not well with me. Because there's no differentiation between the self. There's not a self here that's illumining this thought or that thought. There's just the mind. Right? And so when the mind is behaving adharmically, then because of the pain that creates, that mind feels at odds. It becomes a ripu. It becomes an enemy to me. Because it's creating pain. All I want to do is get rid of it. Now think about it. When your mind is creating pain for you, you want to change it. You know? And you can have any, you can talk about it that I want to get rid of it. I want to change it. I want to transform it. I want to stop it. I want to divert it. But whatever I say is I want it to go away, and I want back a condition where I can say all is well with me. Okay? So what is giving me that condition, right, is the way that I approach the world and I approach my life and I approach the mind itself. Well, this takes it into another level. How do I approach my mind itself? Because just like if you approach the, we can go like this. How do I approach the world? I'm using dharma and adharma now. I approach the world dharmically. Dharmically means what? Let's put it like this. I approach the world dharmically. What would that mean? Do unto others as you would have done to yourself. Golden rule. It's very simple. Ahimsa, non-injury. These are ahimsa, non-injury, the golden rule, all of these things are definitions of dharma. And then that definition can be broken down to finer and finer and finer details. But the basic definition of dharma is ahimsa, And then in India, it's do it, the golden rule in this form, do unto others as you would have done do to yourself, and don't do to others as you would not do to yourself. So that's just the general dharma. So say, if I treat the world like that, then my mind will enjoy some shanti. Now, going inward, because this is going to be true on every level, how do I treat my mind? How do I treat my complexes? How do I treat the sorrows and the hurts and the imperfections I have and the way the different problems I have in my mind? How does my buddhi treat the manas? You know what I mean by that? The manas is a fluctuating mind with the moods and the emotions and the complexes and all of the things that the whole bag of baggage. All the shadow material, everything is included in the manas. How does the buddhi treats the world with dharma, ahimsa, hopefully, you know, ahimsa, golden rule. How does the buddhi treat the manas, the mind? How does the buddhi, we can even go like this. How does the buddhi treat the buddhi? How does the observing ego, right, hold the Karyakarana Sangata? How does the observing ego hold this person? How does the buddhi, with all of its knowledge, hold the entirety of my person? How does it hold the body? Does it hold the body with ahimsa, non-injury? Does it respect the body? Is it kind to the body? Is it respectful of the body? Is it critical of the body? Like, oh, you're so homely. You're so fat. You know? Some people are very, very critical of their body. I don't like the way you look. I don't like your nose. No, really. There's a judge, the mind, the buddhi can be very negative toward the body, you know? Or you're not healthy enough, you're not this, you're not that. But can be very cruel to the body. That's not ahimsa. That's not doing to others. Imagine saying to somebody, you know, I don't like the way you look and you're really fat. You know? And your nose should be different too. So it won't happen. You never think like that, hopefully. But think like that, you know. And if the person is sick, you'll be compassionate and try to help it get well. Get the right food and rest and try to help, you know. But that dharma has to be turned toward this body. The same dharma that you turn toward the world has to be turned. You have to be a friend to the world, you know. You have to be a friend to the body. And to your sense organs. To the thoughts, to your mind, to the moods and the feelings and the reactions and the hurts and the pains, just the whole, you know, the poor mind with all of the emotional trauma of being an ajnani, you know, lifetimes of ajnana, and there's so much trauma there and so much growth that has to take place. There's so many hurts that are brought about by ajnana. How does the buddhi hold that mind? Does it hold it with compassion? Even in the world of ajnanam, without even thinking of knowledge, this is in therapy, we deal with this. Does the buddhi hold the growing, maturing mind with all of its hardships and all of its hurts and pains? Is it a friend? Does it rescue the mind? Does it try to help? To make things better, you know, to be a mentor, to be a friend, to be a good mother, to be caring. Does it do that like it would do to the, if you're dharmic, you know, if you have those values as you would do to others? Do you do it to the mind? Because, you know, if you're not doing that, then what are you doing? Mm-hmm. That's the avasadiyate. It's a na'atmanam, you know, avasadiyate. Don't destroy. Don't destroy yourself. Don't hurt yourself. This avasadi, it means all these things. Don't destroy yourself. Don't kill yourself. Don't harm yourself. It's just, you know, don't harm the self. Don't harm the body. Don't harm the mind. Don't harm these hurts, this part of you that is hurt. Don't hurt it. Instead, uddharet means save it. Rescue. Uddharet means to rescue. Rescue it. Be you alone, then atma eva, atmanah bandhu. You alone can be, you alone can be, you alone are the bandhu, the friend of the self. Or you alone are the atma, are the ripu, are the enemy of the self. It's really up to you. And this, we don't think about this. This is a powerful verse, actually, because we don't think about it. That really, it all rests with me, how I hold you. And how I hold the body, the mind, the sense organs. How I hold the situation. Am I holding the situation? And am I holding myself as a friend? Am I being a friend? Or am I being an enemy? You know what an enemy, we'll see in later verse, but an enemy is, and in Swamiji's handout here, if you read it, talks about enemy, and Shankara talks about an enemy really is somebody who doesn't like you. You know, somebody who tries to hurt you, to do damage to you. That's an enemy. A friend is somebody who protects you, who cares for you, who looks out for your interests. So now it becomes, it's very sobering. Are you a friend to yourself, or are you an enemy? And that can be a real awakening, because if you are an enemy to yourself, you don't realize that you're an enemy. So it has to be pointed out. Because this inimical part usually is something that is kind of, interjected from, it's taken in from childhood. Like, for instance, if you had cranky parents, you know, or cruel parents, or hurtful, critical parents, you interject that critical parent. You interject that, just naturally, the psyche does it, interjects it when you're young. Like if the parent's always saying, oh, you're so stupid, you know. One patient client was telling me today, in fact, that his father would always say, you know, his one client, I mean, I've heard this over and over, even in my own life, you know, you're so stupid, or how could you do that, or, you know, why can't you get this together, this type of thing, you know, all growing up, you know. And so what does he interject? You're so stupid. Why do you get this to, why can't you get this together? Why can't you do anything right? That's the voice that's talking. And the problem is that for that voice started in childhood. I mean, the little child interjects that voice and then lives with it. And so the child becomes an adult who still has that voice going on and totally takes it for granted. Until you point out, you know, that voice is not being very nice to you. You have to point it out, and then the person will say, oh my gosh. If you say, you know, would you ever treat anybody that you know like that? No. What I'm saying is that dynamic remains unconscious. Mm. You don't even realize that it's happening. Once you become conscious of it, you can do something about it. You can say, no, I don't want to talk to myself like that. And you can even be compassionate to that voice, realizing that you were a child when that voice was interjected. And you can say to that voice, the reason you're talking like that is because that's how your mother talked to you, or that's how your father talked to you, you know? But you don't have to talk to yourself like that. And that it will all transform. It will all change. It changes through consciousness. This is, I mean, it's not that hard to do once it's understood and brought into consciousness. And it makes all of the difference in a person's shanti, in a person's inner space, their inner peace. It's not a difficult thing. It's just an unknown thing. Once it becomes known, it's very obvious and very easy. But you can't assume that people know this. They honestly don't know it until they do. They don't know it until they do. Mm. And so it's, though it can seem very natural and simple to you after at a point, you shouldn't take for granted that this is something that everybody knows, because they don't, you know. But this is exactly what this verse is about. Now, you take it farther now. So we have the world, we have the way we treat ourselves. And now, in terms of knowledge for the mumukshu, again, the buddhi is the one who is gaining knowledge. Right? The buddhi. It is gaining knowledge. And with that knowledge, it's able to bring the mind back. Bring the manas back. Manas means, the manas is, you know, all of the desires, all of the ajnanam, all of the false conclusions, all of the habitual ways that we behave in the world. That's all manas. It's just shadow. It's just happening, right? It's reaction, just natural, automatic reactions. The buddhi now gains knowledge. It gains understanding. For a while, the manas is going to be stronger than the buddhi, in a sense. All of the reactions, the habitual ways of behaving, become stronger. And when it is stronger, it is inimical to you because it's creating pain. When the buddhi, the one who has knowledge, becomes stronger, then it is the friend. Then your mind becomes a friend to you. Right? Because it's able to hold the reins of the mind, hold the reins of the sense organs, and allow you to have a choice about how you're going to respond in the world. And so the buddhi that gains knowledge, as the buddhi gains knowledge, it's able to rein in, you know, all of the past ways of behaving that were inimical to you. You know? And so the buddhi, in fact, it can be your worst enemy when it's confused, or it can be your best friend. For the jnani, the buddhi is the best friend, because the buddhi is a jnani, and it holds the reins of the mind, manas, and the mind and the body. That whole kariya karana sangata is held in the reins of the buddhi, which is a jnani. So that buddhi becomes your best friend. And so, let's look at the next verse, because it continues on with this.
Bandhuratmātmanastasya yenātmāyavātmanājitaḥ anātmanastuṣatrutve anātmanastuṣatrutve varate tātmāya vaśatruvat varate tātmāya vaśatruvat. So going along the same line. Banduhu atma atmanaha tasya yena atma eva atmana jitaha anatmanaha tu shatrutve varateta atma eva shatruvat. He says, Bandhu Atma. The Atma is a friend. Bandhu. Atma is a friend. Atmanaha tasya. For the self, the mind is a friend. For that one, by whom yena atma eva atmana jitaha. The mind is a friend for the one by whom the mind itself is controlled. Jitta means controlled. It means the kariya karana sangata is controlled. Jitta is conquered. It comes from ji, means to conquer. So the mind, the body, the sense organs, by the one by whom that is conquered, that one, the mind, is a friend. It's exactly what I'm saying. By conquered, it means that the buddhi can say yes or no, and the mind, the body, the sense organs obey. Right? Like if the mind can say, wow, I really want that ice cream, even though it's totally not good for me, and it'll put on those extra 2 or 3 pounds I really don't want. Boy, that looks good. The buddhi can say, and I really mean this, the buddhi can say yes or no. It has the, really, it could say yes, but it can also say no. It has that control. As opposed to saying, you know, this is different than saying the buddhi could say no, but but it won't. You know, that's like an alcoholic. An alcoholic will say, you know, of course I
I can stop drinking.
Of course I don't have to take that drink. Of course not. You know, but I you know, that's the problem. So jittaha means that the mind has that shamatvam and dhamma. Shama and dhamma, that's a good way to look at it. Shama means the buddhi, even in reference to the mind, it has shama. It means that a thought comes, and then you can entertain the thought or you can let it go. That's shama. But for most of us, I'd say 90% of the thoughts do come and go. And you can let them go. But there's, you know, that 10%. The thought comes and it just grabs you. The buddhi could say, go, go. There's no control. You know, no ability to just let it go. So no shama. And dhamma is more on a physical level, where I might be strangling by the thought or the emotion, but I still have control over the action that I take. That's dhamma. So to have the shama and dhamma, you know, is really what we talk about with the jitendriya. Means that your karmendriyas, your jnanendriyas, your organs of action, your organs of sense organs are in your hands. So another word we use for that is vashi. Vashi means I'm holding it. I'm holding it in my hands. You know, I can decide what I'm going to do. That's a jitendriya. And so here he's saying the atma, the mind is a friend to the one who has control of the mind. Right? Or it goes, the mind is a friend to the one who has control of the sense organs, the mind, the manas, the karmendriyas. That is that person, that is a bandhu. For that person, the mind is a bandhu, is a friend. But then he says, anat manahatu, but for the one who is anatma. Here, anatma means that one who is not, does not have control. Right? The one who is anatma means the one who's not like this. So the one who doesn't have that control, that person, that mind, abides shatrutve as an enemy. It says, anatmanahatu shatrutve, for that type of person, that atma, shatrutve varte ta atma eva. That person is existing as an enemy. Shatrutve is like that person, like an enemy, is relating, is abiding in me as an enemy. It's inimical to me. Right? Because it's not helpful. It's not being a friend. It's not doing for me what is helpful to me, what brings about ananda. Now my mind is behaving in a way that causes me pain. Just think about it, really. I mean, it's really so simple. It's so clean in a way. If the mind, the buddhi, is behaving in a way that is hurting me, that is causing me pain, who does that? That's what a shatru is. An enemy. An enemy is a person who hurts me, who causes me pain, who doesn't have my best interests, who doesn't like me. You know, that's an enemy. And so the mind can be like an enemy. It's existing there with, and it says, an shatrutve means it's existing in the state of an enemy. Shatrutva means enemy-ness, being an enemy. So it's varteta, means it's abiding, there. The mind is abiding there in the state of being an enemy. just like an enemy in the world. So it says Shatruvat means like an enemy in the world. This mind abiding inside is abiding inside of me, just like an enemy. What mind is not abiding like an enemy, but is abiding as a friend, is that mind, you know, which is controlled by the buddhi, right? The mind that the mind which has control, the buddhi which has control, right? The karya kalana sangata, the body mind sense organs, by whom is by the buddhi which is controlling that, then that buddhi abides as a friend, right? So it's simple, it's very simple, but then it's simple to say it and simple to understand it, but then we have to go on to see exactly how to do that, right? How to do, because we all want that. You can say that and say, yes, that makes so much sense. You know? But then we have to know, what is the trick? Right? The trick is that there is a, in order to make that a reality, there is a total shift in the way we view reality. Because if we view reality from the vantage point of Ajnanam, which means that truly, I do need this to be happy, and truly this person is doing this which is robbing me of my happiness, because if I don't have that, I won't be happy. And therefore, this person is intruding or taking away something from me, and if that is that I need to be happy, and therefore I am angry at this person, right? And this person deserves my anger, because this person is actually doing something which is harming me. That's objectively true. It is objectively true within the world of samsara, right? I needed this in order for my life to be whole and complete. And this person is stopping me from having that on purpose. Right? And so this person is attacking me, is an enemy to me, is hurting me, and therefore my anger is very justified. And so don't tell me not to be angry. Look at what they're doing.
See,
the thing is within this worldview, all of that is true. The person can be doing it on purpose and making my life miserable because I had so depended on this to be happy. This is samsara. I mean, we have levels and layers of all of this. It's not like you don't know what I'm talking about. You know it from the smallest little irritants to the huge, monstrous, terrible things that have been done to hurt me. Everybody has their stories. And some of them, really, the behavior is inimical. People do behave as enemies, you know, to what I believe that I need to be happy. So all of it's there, and my anger is justified within that worldview. You know, and so I'm continually getting hurt by the world. Even you can say even like this, a parent is an abusive parent. You know, critical parent that has caused untold damage. You know, and so I can be terribly critical, objectively. You know. This person did this, this, and that. So all of these angers, all of these emotions, all of these hurt feelings, you know, the agitations, the anxieties, all of them have a reason within samsara. Because you have to remember that within samsara, my ananda, my well-being, is dependent on my situation in the world. It is dependent upon the fulfilling of desire, of my desires. And some of those desires are unspoken desires, like a little child, you know, is not going to say, you know, I have a desire for mommy and daddy to love me. They don't know the words to say that. But of course, they do have that desire. But an adult who probably won't say those words either will say, you know, I have a desire for my employer and my colleagues to love and respect me. You know, they might not want to say that, but it's actually true. Right? Because we depend upon that mirroring from the world to give us a certain shanti, to give us a feeling of being loved. We depend upon it. In fact, Kohut, who's a psychologist that I've studied quite a bit, he even said that mirroring, does everybody know what mirroring means? It means that if you and I are in a conversation and I smile at you as we're talking, we're relating, you would smile back. It's like there's a dialogue that's taking place that we're both engaged in. And you can see, like, with parents with their child, they look at their child and smile and give the child a smile back. And they're just mirroring back and forth, you know. That there's a communication. It's almost like a oneness taking place in that dialogue. That's what we call mirroring. Kohut says that just as oxygen, the body requires oxygen, the psyche requires that mirroring. The body requires oxygen to survive. Without it, it'll die. The psyche requires that mirroring, that positive regard, that connection, in order for it to survive. We've even done studies, terrible studies, on a long time ago with little children where the mother would not mirror the child. The little child was, you know, trying to get the mother's attention. She was holding the infant on her lap, and the child was trying to get the attention of mommy and all of this, and looking and smiling and all of this, and the mother just kept a stone face. And the child tried and tried all kinds of ways to get the attention, and getting more and more as they were failing to do it, getting more and more upset until the child just basically went berserk, disintegrated. Because it couldn't, it's terrible. They can't do these type of studies anymore. If they show these studies, they still show when you're studying to be a psychologist, they show these studies, but they were all done like in the 30s and 40s. It's because they're not allowed anything like that anymore. It's just so traumatic, you know. So why I'm saying this is that there is an order to this samsara. There is pain that is created in the samsara. There's a lot of pain that is created. And this is also why, it's created in an orderly way. That's why we can talk about how these situations create pain, you know. We can give templates of pain creation and templates of joy creation because there are certain dynamics that we can speak to. That's why in some of the meditations that Swamiji's been doing, he speaks to objectifying the order in which the situations have unfolded in your life that have created pain. Created agitation, like say, for instance, say something happened today that created hurt or agitation. If you were to, in your meditation, objectify that whole situation, what happened to you, how the other person was involved, what the history of it is, what that person had been through that caused that person to get to that state, to act that way toward you, that you reacted to, and you reacted to it because of this and because of that. And you just create, you objectify the whole order that went into the production of this situation. Right? There you'll have a good view of samsara. It's a wonderful view of samsara. And in a way, it releases you of the responsibility. You know, you see, releases you of the responsibility in this sense. You understand why you were hurt or why you were upset and what happened with this person. You see Ishvara. You see it all as part of the natural two and two makes four, you know, and the unfoldment of situations of Ishwara, which has to do with pleasure and pain and joy and hate and all of these type of emotions that are generated, you know, generated by desire, really. They're all generated by desire, by kama. And the kama, I need this in order to be full and complete, is generated by the ajnanam. And so there's, and this is understood, there's a lot, you can have tremendous compassion for the amount of unwinding that has to take place on the part of the mumukshu, the karma yogi, who's gaining this knowledge. There's so much unwinding that has to take place because the problems that the ajnani, that the mind of the ajnani is suffering from, are logical. Based upon the ajnanam, which has caused you to relate to the world in a particular way, the pain and misery and suffering and complexes and all of those are natural, logical offshoots of your experience. And so now all of that has to be healed. You know? And how to heal it? Well, the buddhi, as the buddhi gains knowledge, that buddhi becomes the wise person, you know, that then has to hold not only the world, your world of experience, but also this inner world, your inner world, that is slowly unwinding itself from all of these hurts and pains and ways of being with the world that are based on ajnanam. The samsara. It's like our psyche is full of samsara, right? Because it's a product of samsara. It's a product of ajnanam. And so there's a whole network of samsara there. Whole network of ways of behaving with the world that has hurt us. And so all of this stuff slowly unwinds in the light of my knowledge. But part of the knowledge itself, which why Krishna takes so much time in the Bhagavad Gita, part of this knowledge is understanding, you know, how to be a friend to yourself. Because these verses, how to be a friend to yourself. Because the friend, the one who has now the buddhi that has knowledge, now has to help the manas, the psyche, unwind in the light of knowledge. And pull it back, care for it, help it, be a benefactor, be a friend. Swamiji will say, be a friend, philosopher, and guide. Which it's kind of a cliche, friend, philosopher, and guide. But when you think of it, you know, the friend is the part that wishes me well and wants to help. The philosopher is the Vedanta, the Jnanam. The guide is the one who gives direction. You know, the one that can make decisions and say, this is not the best for you. You know, this is better to do this. Or, yes, this was a mistake. We can do it better next time this way. But that friend, philosopher, and guide are all one and the same person, you know, so that the guide doesn't become an ogre, you know, and the friend somebody who's loose. It's that the buddhi itself is a jnani, is the swami, and is able to really hold you. And then, when that is understood, you find that the psyche itself starts to relax. Your mind starts to relax because instead of having a critical voice inside, you have somebody who wants to help. That is night and day. There's somebody, the buddhi wants to help, who cares about you, who wants to guide you, who is not somebody who's ripping you apart or criticizing everything that you do wrong, you know. It says, okay, well, we can do it better the next time. Don't worry, we'll do it better next time. It gives so, there's love there. And that love gives space, gives inner space, gives shanti. And then that's the mind that's really capable now of sitting more and more just with myself. Mm. So you know, kind of attacking this on all ends. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Take a minute. Purnamadah, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamadachate, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnamevavasishate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha, Hari Om.
Massage.
You know, it is key. These verses, these verses, I think that they're so important. I think Swamiji holds them as key for Antakarna Shuddhi. Really?
Yeah.
You know, because without,
I mean,
the to be a friend to yourself.
No, but I mean, which verses? I mean,
The two that we just did.
Oh, right.
Yeah. He bases so much on that because without it, the shanti, the mind can't relax. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the freedom to mature and to grow. Just like, if you think about it, just like your child could never grow without your friend, philosopher, and guide. You know, without that love. The same internal space remains crippled because there's not an understand, not bringing in the friend.
So he learned this over the years.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he did. And he's, I mean, he taught this when we were in the 70s. But Swamiji keeps learning how experimenting how to make something understood.
Mm-hmm.
But this is core. And I still, to me, this is core because I realized this early on when Swamiji was teaching in the 70s. And I still, to this day, hold it as a pivotal recognition for my own growth, for my own peace of mind, that it was this real understanding that changed everything. Not that I didn't have a lot of growing and a lot of everything to do, but it created the space inside to let that happen.
That kind of inner voice.
Mm-hmm. That inner friend. The discovery of that inner friend instead of a critic. Or I didn't even think I was not terribly critical. There was just no inner friend there. It wasn't that there was a critic. But the positive wasn't there. You know, and that's what made a huge difference. It's almost like internalizing Swamiji in a way. You know?
Yeah. Interjecting him.
Mm-hmm. That attitude. But when I understood that, I didn't even think of it as interjecting him, but I think that's what it was, actually, because of his kindness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd never met anybody like that before.
Yeah.
I mean,
not in such a constant way.
So, you know, it makes total sense that the buddhi needs to kind of hold the reins of the manas. And it also kind of feels like, and it's like makes all sort of sense what you said, you know. It's interesting when you have a little child, like, you know, we have, and we realize the tension with each other, and we realize at the same time how much love would pour into her, right? And it becomes like, the contrast becomes obvious. You know, as if there's some kind of, it's like the Buddha is naturally conditioned to see that this little being needs only love.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it switches to the relationship of the two adults, then that awareness process kind of crumbles through the conditioning of the manas that kind of takes over the lack of buddhi development or something.
Yeah, and but what
or,
can...
I mean, what's really, you know, why is that buddhi losing that awareness process, you know, when it comes to these intimate relationships that we're all, like what you were saying, you know, where basically it's like two people meeting in the vulnerability of their own childhood. You know, you can in a way, so you can say that, you know.
That's right.
I mean, it's maybe an oversimplification, but I mean, there's some truth to that, right?
Absolutely.
So...
In fact, there's been books written on it.
Oh, yeah.
In psychology.
Sure, I mean, it's all about that in a certain way, right? But to kind of discover that in your own way, you know, is even kind of... It's profound.
It is profound. I also think that even in interpersonal, in your relationship,
mm-hmm.
that if you... Once you... once it becomes natural, that inner friend becomes natural, a way to being with yourself, it does really affect your relationship with your partner also.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have that way of being toward yourself, it becomes the way you are
mm-hmm.
and toward everyone.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a while because there are so many triggers out here. But the same space that you give yourself your own failures, holding your own failures, you give that to others.
And you said there was kind of a, this was easy, but there's a trick in accomplishing this easy viewpoint.
Yeah, that's what we're starting to talk about more.
Oh, good. Good,
you know, having the viewpoint, I don't have any problem with that, actually. You know, in fact, I feel like that has been resonating for a long time in me. I think the real problem I have is, like, when I feel beaten over the head, there's just something... And what is that phenomenon, really? You know, is that just kind of... Where does the awareness process... And that's so interesting. I don't quite get that. And maybe that's what we're going to get into...
What do you feel beaten over the head by somebody else or by yourself?
Well, yeah, I mean, I just experience it in our relationship, you know, but I don't experience it really, you know, with anything else out there, you know. But it's like when there's a certain kind of trigger, when we trigger each other, then there's a certain kind of real breakdown of that awareness process.
Yeah.
And it becomes like a survival thing.
Yeah.
You know? It really becomes a core survival. It's not... And there's even a witness there who can see it. But that witness even says, okay, I'm surrendering my witnessing to the unconscious that is in reactivity because that reactivity is appropriate, you know?
Yeah,
there's even that justification, what
you
were talking about. There is this whole thing. It's so sophisticated how the mind sets up that stage and goes for it.
Yeah.
That the Buddha actually, even though the Buddha is present, just gets lost in the dust somewhere, you know? And
because there's so much pain and so many triggers. But that's why I think that Swamiji is putting emphasis on these type of meditations where you actually go back. Like say one of these big things that have happened. Then in your meditation you go back and you just objectify the whole thing. And then you can understand it, why it happened. You don't try to pretend like it hasn't happened or it shouldn't have happened or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It did happen. Mm-hmm. And you can see all of the cause and effect, multidimensional cause and effects that went into, and unconscious stuff, all kinds of stuff that went into creating that. Mm-hmm. And then you can objectify it and give it to Ishwara.
What?
You objectify it and you give it to Ishwara. You understand this is Ishwara. And in doing that, then you have objectified it and free yourself of it. And also you're not, when you objectify the whole like that, you're not one thing. You're the whole, you're objectifying the whole, and you are part of that whole.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like there's you and your partner and everybody else that was involved in it. That's the whole scene.
The story changes.
That's the whole, you're part of the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and all of the pain and everything. It's not just your pain, it's her pain and some pain, so many levels of it. But now all of that, you see, all of that is Ishwara, and you see why it's produced. You see the laws involved in producing it. If you do this, then this produces this, and this produces this.
Mm. So and you don't blame yourself? I mean,
you don't blame. You understand. And it just gives you a little space, that's all. And, I mean, life is hard. People, in life you do have people that don't like you, people who are inimical to you, and all kinds of things are going on in life. Swamiji once said, I've just become a screwless screw. Because a lot of difficult situations, difficult people, screwing him. You know, but
I don't understand what that means.
Well, screwless screw is that
it doesn't react back.
It doesn't react back. You keep trying to screw it, you know.
It's a hopeless.
But nothing happens. It's like all of the what do you call that? The threads are,
That sounds good.
That's very creative. But
you have to be a screwless screw.
Yeah. You can't tell many people that.
I don't think he knew the other meaning. he was very literal, no, screw, you know, yeah. Screw.
These verses really speak to me because what helped me, like 30 years ago was psychology and learning about, I would hear that voice that seemed like it was natural,
me,
and just learning that it was exaggerated or, I didn't have to believe everything, and then being shown how to think differently. It was like I had no idea how to.
It's like a big awakening.
Yeah, I have to think.
Because we don't objectify our mind or listen to how we talk to ourselves and that type of thing. You know? And then with knowledge, once you understand that, then the buddhi has that buddhi that has knowledge can be the one that's holding you, the one that is kind, the one that's caring, the one that can make sense out of what's going on in a meaningful way. You know. I don't mean in a goody-goody Pollyanna way. I'm just in a real way, in a way that's helpful, in a way that is real, that has a grip on reality, the reality of the self, the reality of Ishwara, the reality of Ananda, of what is true in terms of my well-being and the stability of myself and what I really need and what is prarabdha, the prarabdha karma. All of these things, give a huge relief to the mind. Knowledge. But the mind can't just change, lifetimes of patterns and hurts overnight. It has to slowly assimilate and grow in the light of knowledge. Just like a plant grows
This is so idyllic. And I resonate so well with me, you talking this way. But I remember growing up as a teenager and young man in L.A. And it was like a madhouse. All these voices coming at you, you know, and then trying to find a voice that could soothe yourself inside.
Well, I think maybe with psychology's done, there's some really good things in psychology now, but I think with without Vedanta, without some learning how to talk with yourself, there is nobody inside. There's no stable person inside. Because the mind isn't stable, it's changing all the time. You don't know what it's going to do next. And an Ajnani doesn't, an Ajnani does not have a constant self because there's identification with the mind and the mind isn't constant. Right? And the mind is always changing, so you don't know what it's going to do next. It's behaving well now for the moment, but you have no idea what's going to throw it off. And I used to worry about that when I was younger and a teenager. I'd be fine, but I knew that something could get me. And I would be really upset or really hurt, you know, or really angry. And something would trigger it. And I didn't know when that something was going to come, but it always would. Something would come and trigger it. And then I would be upset or I would be hurt or have some awful feeling inside. It's terrible. And then you can't just make it go away. You know what I mean? And there's no self. Because the self is totally identified with whatever the state of mind is. It's horrible situation. So we take our once that's not your situation, it's so natural when you gain knowledge rests very lightly because yourself is yourself and it is constant and it's always present and your mind just rests there. It recognizes that and so that problem is no longer there. So you have to remember back. And I can remember back what that was like. And the worry it used to cause me. And the, you know, just the awful feelings.
I had a question about the anvayavratirika. So, I mean, that's sort of related to this, right? Because you have to sort of understand that you're not these various emotions that are coming and going.
Yeah.
But, so the confusion for me is that, okay, so I have probably a conception or misconception of myself as, you know, I'm Seshadri, this person, etc., etc. So if I were to do that, then through every experience, I would think that Seshadri is present. So then I would just look at the self as this being. So why have I gone wrong then?
Okay, the Seshadri is Brahman. Now, so what you have to recognize is that that's why we break the upadhi, the body, mind, sense organs, down into its components. Okay, so like for instance, the physical body. You are always present to the physical body as long as you're in the waking state. But when you're in the dream state, you've taken another body. Right? So experientially, I'm just talking. Okay? But you are still there. So, physical body is I am. Dream body is I am. But the dream body negates the physical body. Right? So, in terms of my experience. So now I have to be able to differentiate who is the I, what is the nature of the I that is there in the presence or the absence of the physical body or the dream body. Right? So that's, you're going into that kind of innermost self that is not connected, is the self of both but not connected to either. So now say, and that is you. When you say, I am Seshadri, you're actually identifying the Atma. You've just superimposed this body, mind, sense organs on it. But the recognition, what you'll come to recognize is that the one you say is Seshadri has no birth or death. It has no, you will never change. That you are Brahman. That's what has to be understood. So how to understand that is to say, okay, who is Seshadri really? Because I am the one who is here, present to all experience. So who is that? You have to be able to differentiate that me from all of the experiences that come and go. And then you'll realize, oh, that Seshadri is Brahman. That one that I have taken to be the body, and so when this body dies, I will die. That one is actually the Anvayavyatireka. When the body is, I am. When the body is gone, I am. When the thoughts are, I am. When the thoughts are gone, I am. When the emotions are and the emotions are gone, I am. That's the Anvayavyatireka. That's what needs to be recognized.
But sort of, isn't my personality sort of always there? Even in my dream, I still have this conception of...
The self of the personality, that self that makes you think that the personality is always there, that self is Brahman. Okay. Now, when you say the personality is always there, actually, there are ways of behavior that you can identify that you'll call the personality, but those ways of behavior are continually changing and modifying and coming and going. You're behaving this way, then you're behaving that way. When you're behaving this way, you're not behaving that way. So you're looking at all of these changing phenomena as your personality. What I'm saying is, right? Those are changing phenomena. What makes them seem as one being is that which isn't changing. And that is the conscious being. That's the one that objectifies the whole thing, that lights up the whole thing, that is stable, that is present to the whole thing.
Could you say that again?
The one that, the conscious being that lights up all of the changes, that is stable, that is present to all of the machinations of my mind and my emotions and feelings and reactions and all of these things. All of these things are coming and going and changing and modifying and transforming. It's dynamic, right? But I the self, am present to all of it. And the self that was present to this personality yesterday that is modifying, 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 is the same self that is present to this personality today. I used to be like this, now I'm like this.
So is that right? What makes me feel like I'm the same person?
Right, because you are the same person. Right? And that same one has to be, that's the Viveka. You have to recognize, there's something about me, this Kariya Karma Sangata that includes conscious being, that is stable. I am always present, no matter what the thought, what if the feeling, whether I'm happy or whether I'm sad. Whatever experience it is, that experience is, I am at the center of it and I'm always the same. In fact, next time you have an unhappy emotion or you're agitated, and then you have a happy one. Every time you have an emotion, just recognize, just say to yourself, okay, I am aware of this emotion. Just say that, I'm aware of this emotion. What is the I like? Just the me, the one who's aware of the emotion. Then you have an agitated thought. And you say to yourself, I am aware of this agitation. What am I like? The one who's aware of it. And you have a happy thought. You say, I am aware of this happiness. What am I like? You know, the one for whom this happiness is. You realize that there's no difference in the I. It doesn't matter what the emotion is. It doesn't matter what the perception is. It doesn't matter what the thought is. Every single time you notice, this me, I am untouched. That's what you have to discern. And you have to discern it because the two are happening in the same place. There's the emotion and there's me. So now you have to do a little viveka there.
So even after all these years, there's been no growth in this?
There's no change in the self. Yeah. Not even all these years, all of these forever.
So is it like the distinction between me saying, say, no, I am this personality, and saying that I'm the one who is sort of aware of this personality.
Yeah, you can say, that's a good way to make the differentiation. And then you can say, I am the one who lights up this personality, I'm aware of this personality, and you also It's not like the I is here and the personality is over here. It's that I am the changeless self that is the very being of this personality.
Mm.
But the personality is changing. The personality is made of thoughts, moods, emotions, behavioral patterns, so many things that you've brought with you from past lives and then have, you know, also taken from your parents and family and upbringing. It's complex. The jiva, you know, the body, mind, sense complex is complex. You know, it's taken in so, been affected by so many different, you know, situations and people and places. And, but it's dynamic and changing.
So then you think, like if you can recognize that self as being self and body, mind, sense organs as being different from that. And then, but then still, you know, there could be this habitual identification. And then to kind of break that, then would the next step be, like, to see that as part of Ishvara rather than as you so much, you know? You know what I mean? Because I think that ahankara is still kind of...
To see it all as... Yeah, you can see all of it as Ishvara.
Yeah.
And also Nididhyasana. Nididhyasana, where you just slow things down and allow your mind to get used to yourself instead of that total identification, so that the mind is only, its only focus is on its thoughts and its feelings and its emotions. When you slow things down with Nididhyasana, the mind then starts recognizing its own self instead of what it's thinking about. And then when it does that, then it gets to come into relationship, in a sense, with what is real, what is constant. And then it becomes safe and secure, because there's nothing it can do about the self. It can't hurt it. It can't get rid of it. It's safe, because the self is benign. So then the mind has a home. And the mind always rests in the home of the self. You know, kind of funny language in a way, because the mind is never away from the self. It's satya mitya, right? But because the mind has only been concerned in its thought life with itself, with its own emotions, with its own thinking, with the world, it's totally missed this, its self. And now, that's what, so when I use the word, it comes into relationship with that self, means its thought life is now not just ricocheting off one thought, off another thought, and then off of the world. It is now resting and in relationship with its own being. And that being is stable. And so then the mind, we can say the mind has a self. Or that it had a self, of course, but it didn't act like it. Right? It acted like it was the self. But the mitya itself was the self. So it had no self, because the mitya is always changing. Right? So there's no place to rest. Whereas for the jnani, the mind is always... We say, Bhagavan in the Bhagavad Gita says reveling. That's a good word. It's always... The mind is always reveling in the self. Because the self is the home base, and it's constant, and it's safe, and it's full and whole and strong and complete. It's everything you want to be. It's everything the mind wants to be. It's everything the upadhi wants to be. Is what you are. Is strong and stable and whole and, you know, together. The self is together.
It's the white knight.
You can't fall apart.
The mind has somebody together inside.
They had a 2-hour show on television about happiness.
I saw that. I didn't watch it, though. I saw that it's on television.
Part of it was so interesting. You know, the different assumptions about happiness.
I'll watch that. I was going to see what they're doing.
So far, I haven't come upon... I haven't watched the whole thing, but one person saying, well, that's your true nature. That's why it feels... You know what I mean? It's like that.
Well, you know,
that's probably not known.
They rate countries according to the happiness. And you know, Mexico, it's way above us. It's way up there.
Well, in Bhutan, they have a ministry of happiness or something.
Huh?
In Bhutan, they have a ministry of happiness.
Dharma, family, there's so many things that create
exactly.
culture that create a much more stable, peaceful, you know, happier environment.
Yeah.
But that's all on Tukaram Mission.
It is. Yeah, and a society that is following a value system that gives more shanti to the individuals.
But it's still not knowledge.
How about your little Tibby? Is she having a good time?
What's the shaman?
Is Tibby having a good time? Reveling.
What's the shama? You said the
shama. Shama dhamma.
And what's the shama?
Shama is, you could say, control of the mind, but really understand what it means is that as the thoughts and emotions rise in the mind, you have the freedom to let them go. Whereas the lack of shama is when, like, an emotion rises and grabs you. There's no letting it go. I mean, it's got you by the throat.
Yeah.
You know, and you just have to wait for it to decide to relieve you of itself. That's when shama hasn't worked. And now dhamma is the ability when shama hasn't worked and you're in the middle of some sort of a reaction or being grabbed by something. Dhamma is the ability to contain that and not act it out. Except if you're really angry with somebody and you want to just slug them, that's what Swamiji, example Swamiji will use, the ability to hold back on, you know, your anger.
So you can be caught in shama, or shama is not happening actually, because that freedom kind of gets lost and you get into that thought. But then you can still have control with dhamma.
You don't physicalize it, act it out.
So ideally you want to have shama and dhamma, basically.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's what you're going
for. If you have shama, you don't really need dhamma.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you're...
Yeah, it's just an extension of...
The second line of defense or something.
That's exactly.
The reserves.
That's what Swamiji says, the second line of defense. Right.
The reserves come up and say
the kshatriya. Interpretation.
Yeah.
If all else fails.
And if that fails, interpretation.
That was good. This is going to be good. I just keep liking this data more, you know?
All right.
No,